Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Chicago Hamburg 30 podcast, sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg. I'm your host, Andrew Sola, and today we're discussing Chicago sports and also my team in Hamburg, FC St. Pauli. Delighted to have with me today two experts on the history of Chicago sports, Peter T. Alter and Elliot Gorn. Peter T. Alter is the Chicago History Museum's Gary T. Johnson Chief Historian and Director of the Studs Terkel Center for Oral History. Alter also teaches at DePaul University's Public History Program, and he's an expert on the Chicago Black Sox match-fixing scandal of 1919, which we'll discuss in a bit. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
Elliot J. Gorn is Joseph A. Galliano, Chair in American Urban History at Loyola University in Chicago. He is the author of The Manly Art, Bare Knuckles Prize Fighting in America, co-author of A Brief History of American Sports, and editor of Sports in Chicago, published by the University of Illinois Press. Welcome, Elliot.
Thank you.
Peter, Elliot, how about those Chicago White Sox this year?
Apparently, it was just reported that Jerry Reinsdorf, the owner of the team, doesn't believe in or doesn't want to spend money on an analytics department, which analytics, basically very sophisticated statistics have taken over a lot of sports, especially baseball. And Reinsdorf has decided he doesn't like it or doesn't want to spend money on it. And so the Chicago Whites, it's not just that they're doing poorly. We've seen some really outstanding players have their careers tank, probably for the rest of their baseball lives.
Yeah, it does remind me a bit of how things fell apart after the 1919 Black Sox scandal, which we'll, as you said, Andy, we'll talk about in a little bit, but there was a 40-year drought, right? So one wonders how long the drought is until the White Sox are meaningful in the standings again.
Yeah, so just for our audience, as of time of recording, the White Sox record is 36 wins and 117 losses. That is a win record of .235, which is tied for the worst team in history at the moment. And I think if they just manage to win a couple more games, they will officially be the worst team in the history of baseball since the modern period for anyone who's counting.
I think they can do it too.
I know. Well, I read an article that said some White Sox fans are now just going to games to be there on the day that they're officially pronounced the worst team ever. So that's good. You know, you want to witness history, don't you? Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going to get back to Chicago sports, but I wanted to first talk a little bit about my soccer team or football club in Hamburg, FC St. Pauli, who were founded in 1910 in the working class red light district of Hamburg, St. Pauli, which we probably know from the St. Pauli Girl beer, but let me tell you, none of the beers in St. Pauli are non-alcoholic. St. Pauli has been described by The Guardian and The New York Times as the coolest football club on the planet, which I have mixed feelings about. But much like the Cubs, the White Sox, and the Bears, St. Pauli has not been that successful over the years. However, last year, finally, St. Pauli won the second division of the German Football League. So this year, we are playing in the Bundesliga, the top division, against teams that everyone around the world knows, like Bayern Munich, the feared Bayern Munich, and Borussia Dortmund. Sadly, at the time of recording, we have yet to win a game or even draw a game, and we've only scored one solitary goal. So it could be that St. Pauli becomes the worst team to ever play in the Bundesliga, just like this year's White Sox in the major leagues, which would be another wonderful connection between Chicago and Hamburg, the worst teams ever. But I've wondered, Peter and Elliot, is it just because I was born in Chicago that I actually quite enjoy it when my local team loses a lot? Is that a Chicago thing?
Peter?
I think it might be. Yeah, even I had much higher expectations, I don't know why, for the Cubs this year. And then once they started to be bad, I wanted them to be monumentally bad. And they just turned out to be kind of tepid. So
yeah, no one likes merely an average team, do
right.
they? Let's be really good or really bad, but yes. Why bother being somewhere in the middle?
Yes.
I think some of it also is that we've just gotten used to it here. I wasn't born and raised in Chicago. I mean, when the Cubs were a moment when they were starting to get good and then they faltered again around 2007, a friend of mine wanted to have a T-shirt made. They hadn't won the World Series, a championship in 100 years, and he wanted to have a T-shirt made. I'll give them another 100 years and that's it. So I think it's just what we're used to. It's like Stockholm Syndrome or something.
Anyway, what's interesting is despite the Cubs being bad for so long, they still sell out matches. And despite the fact that Zhang Pauli has struggled for so long, it's still very difficult to get tickets. So I want to take this opportunity to explain two parts of the German soccer model for our American audience now that are totally different from how professional sports are structured in the United States. And first is this concept of promotion and relegation, which I love. You know, if the White Sox is the worst team in the history of baseball, why should there be no consequences? Why should they not be forced to play in AAA next year? And then they have to show that they're good enough to play in the major leagues. Well, in the German soccer leagues and all European soccer leagues, the worst teams move down a division and the best teams move up. So it assures you that the best teams are always playing in the top division. So there are real consequences to losing, you know, as the Reinsdorf, the owner of the White Sox, doesn't want to invest in an analytics department, so the White Sox are losing. Well, who cares? The franchise is still worth several billion euros. It's not like they're going to be playing AAA Ames, Iowa next season. So what we have in the U.S. is a sporting monopoly, and there are no consequences for losing. And quite frankly, the owners run the show, and they're quite happy for us to keep spending money for the only league in the States. So the second interesting point I want to make is unique to Germany. It's called the 50-plus-1 rule. So the 50-plus-1 rule means that supporters of the soccer team or any team must have a 50% plus one controlling stake in the operations of the club. So if you are a billionaire and you want to invest in a team, that's fine, but you can never actually control the club. Supporters always have to be in charge. So what are the consequences of this? Most importantly, supporters control ticket prices. So you can still go to St. Pauli for 15 euros, and you can still go see Bayern Munich for 15 euros a game. And this is important because having a loyal customer base, a loyal fan base, is more important than just feeding money into the owners. Also, all these clubs are not-for-profit institutions, so all of the money that they make from television rights and ticket sales, they have to pump back into the local community. So, for example, St. Pauli supports local schools, amateur sports teams, and other social projects because none of the money they make goes to a billionaire or a hedge fund. I should add that the only team in all of U.S. professional sports that does not have private ownership is the Green Bay Packers, the NFL football team, who are publicly owned and not for profit. They're owned by fans who can't own more than 4% of the team. However, Packers tickets still sell for $250 minimum, which is way more than the $15 or 15 euros you'd spend to go to Bayern. So, Peter and Elliot, what do you think? The sporting ecosystems in the U.S. and Germany are really quite different. Do you think American sports would benefit from promotion and relegation? And do you think all clubs should be basically structured like the Green Bay Packers? Small questions.
Yes, of course. As you were kind of describing that, Andy, and thinking about the White Sox being relegated – And who would, I mean, the White Sox park is empty now, right? Who would next season come to see the White Sox play the Iowa Cubs, for example, which is the Cubs AAA team, if they were demoted to AAA? One might argue that they could be demoted lower than AAA, maybe rookie league, you know, ball in Idaho or something.
T-ball?
Yes, T-ball, yes, yes. So, yeah, it's an interesting question. I'm not sure how it would work with our giant stadiums and people generally not showing up, sometimes even for good teams.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a hard conversion, that's for sure. But sports have been for so long. I mean, the proper word in economics, I think, is they're a cartel. It's not just that they're privately owned, but there's virtually no entry into the business. It costs it's very, very expensive. And the cartel, Major League Baseball, the National Football League, the NBA, need to approve new teams. So in baseball, for example, you have the 30 teams. The leagues have expanded some over the last few decades. There used to be, when I was a kid, 16 teams. Now they're, as I say, 30. But all of it tightly controlled by these cartels whose monopoly power has been enforced in the courts. I think it's a great idea. I love it. Many, many more teams not owned privately. I'm sure that would also cut down on players' salary some, though it doesn't in Europe. Europe seems to have gone, in football, seems to have gone more toward an American model of how players are paid. In any event, I think it's a great idea. And relegating the White Sox, as a Cubs fan, I can certainly say that relegating the White Sox permanently is a very attractive option.
So just an interesting point on the empty stadiums. Another team that I support is Kaiserslautern. And they were a huge team for decades and decades. They won the Bundesliga several times. And they got relegated not down to the second league, but down to the third league, and they have a 52,000 seat stadium, and then they would only open like one little section because only 8,000 fans would come, and of course that's a problem. But what are you going to do? You know, those are the rules. You're saddled with this big stadium, and you just have to keep most of it empty. So, who knows? But what about secondly? You know, you mentioned the cartel aspect of this. Shouldn't all sporting teams simply be non-for-profit corporations that are required to funnel profits back into the community?
I'd be very happy with that model, but I'm not sure the owners would be. One of the interesting things about teams in America, it's a little bit like many other things in economics in America, is that no one ever loses money on a sports team. You know, the owners complain about the cost of doing business, especially the cost of players' salaries. But if you have managed to buy a team or buy part of a team in the last several decades, no one has lost money doing that. It hasn't happened. The teams retain their value. They threaten to move to another city to get all kinds of perks. Again, Jerry Reinsdorf here in Chicago is a good example. When they built the United Center on the west side, they needed a new stadium. Chicago Stadium was getting a little old and a little shabby. The city gave away all kind of tax perks to the Chicago Bulls and to the ownership. It's just the way sports business is done in America, and it's certainly not good. It's not good for sport. It's not good for fans, but it's the way things are done. As for empty stadiums, I was at the Cubs game last night. They're clearly out of any kind of contention now. It's a night game in the middle of the week. The stadium holds 40,000. They had 31,000. So they're, you know.
And playing another bad team, right?
A terrible team, yeah. But we won.
Yes. One of those meaningless Pyrrhic victories. Yeah. Yeah, I think just piggybacking on Elliot a little bit, having lived in different places, I remember when we lived in Tucson, Arizona, and there was a ballot measure to approve a new spring training stadium for baseball teams. And you know, the fallacy that these spring training stadiums or any stadia really kind of that are going to create these like long lasting important jobs, you know, beyond temporary construction jobs or, you know, selling t-shirts and hot dogs, you know, has long been like a fallacy in the history of all of building new parks, stadium, arenas in the United States.
Interesting. Okay, well, we're talking about money in sports, but let's go back in history to the early stages of baseball, when presumably owners were not making billions of dollars, and nor were players. And let's revisit the Black Sox scandal of 1919. Peter, this is your wheelhouse, as they say. Uh-huh. Why don't you just introduce an audience that doesn't know much about baseball to the Black Sox and the Black Sox scandal?
Sure. So the Chicago White Sox, the team that we've been maligning quite a bit so far, in the early 20th century was a strong team owned by a Chicagoan, Charles Comiskey. They had won the 1906 World Series in defeating the crosstown rival Cubs. They had also won the 1917 World Series, defeating the New York Giants, now a team that's been in San Francisco for many decades. And they actually were expected to win the 1918 World Series. They did not go to the World Series. 1919 came around. They were odds-on favorites, and they had a solid regular season. And back in an era long before there were layers of playoffs and wild card teams and play-in games and all these kinds of things, if there were two leagues, National League, American League, just a few teams in each league, if you won your league, National or American, you would go to the World Series, which was the championship of baseball. So they faced the Cincinnati Reds, already a longstanding team, but a team that hadn't had a lot of success. Founded in 1869, I believe, and were a definite underdog in sort of pure view of the games and also betting. But the players of the White Sox, many of them very good, chief among them, Shoeless Joe Jackson, say it ain't so, Joe, of course, not something that was probably said, but comes from this World Series. And the way I have become sort of a, I would say, in-house expert at the Chicago History Museum, a decade or so ago, we purchased at auction a major Black Sox legal archive. And in that legal archive, there was a deposition by one of the major participants in the fix, the effort to intentionally lose games by the White Sox, saying, yeah, we were of course, train travel. We're riding to New York City on the train for a road trip to play the Yankees, and we were just BSing, and what would it take for us to intentionally lose games? Of course, modern White Sox fans, it's hard for us, for them to imagine the White Sox intentionally losing games. They they try to win, and they lose them. Although it certainly looks like intentional losing. And the players said, well, let's follow the example of the 1918 Cubs, Chicago Cubs. And there was a rumor up to that point that the 1918 Cubs had intentionally lost to the Boston Red Sox in 1918. And so they
were in the World Series, or
in the World Series. Yeah. And that was the Babe Ruth Red Sox before he was so famous with the Yankees. And when, like, Shohei Ohtani, he was also a pitcher and a great hitter for the Red Sox. So, you know, the story has taken on epic proportions since then, but we believe...
But you missed the key point. The key point was that the accusation, which I guess is true, is that the players did actually intentionally throw games and lost the World Series.
Exactly, yes. As I sometimes do, forgot the punchline, but there is a group of several players. We don't know exactly who. Shoeless Joe Jackson is definitely the most famous among them. Also, their knuckleballer pitcher, Eddie Seacott. And many people believe that both Shoeless Joe and Eddie Seacott probably would be in the Hall of Fame, Baseball Hall of Fame, had they not been implicated. So they did intentionally lose some games. We do have a letter in our collection of a sports writer in the men's room before in White Sox Park, Comiskey Park. And the bettors were in the men's room just saying, you know, it's not going to be long before in this game, before the White Sox intentionally lose this game. That back then the World Series was best out of nine. And I believe that was the eighth game. And sure enough, the White Sox gave up a bunch of runs in the beginning of the game and lost by a lopsided score. We know that bookies and others really came away much richer. There's a New York gangster, low-level gangster, Arnold Rothstein, who's known as the funder of the fix, paying the players. And he's actually, you know, immortalized in The Great Gatsby as well as the guy who fixed the 1919 series. So there's been discussion for now 105 years, which players participated, how badly did they play. Supporters of Shoeless Joe say, well, you know, he batted well in the 300s. He fielded well. So although he may have taken some money to benefit his sister, who was feeling poorly at the time for doctor's bills, really he was on the up and up. From some of our archives, we have private detective reports saying, you know, one player, Swede Riesberg, had a wife in California and a girlfriend on the South Side. And part of his take from the fix was that he set up his girlfriend on the South Side with a beauty parlor. And
so in some respects, nothing changes.
Okay. Yes. Right.
Well, I mean, there's always this fear, even to this day. And mm-hmm. It's not like this is the last game fixing scandal.
No,
I think it's happened. It's even happened in college sports, yes. College basketball, and yeah. All of this stuff. Did anyone ever go to jail? Was this illegal or simply immoral?
There was a trial. So to answer your question, no, not to my knowledge. There was a trial that the players, the White Sox players and a few others from other teams, they were defrauding the public. And there was one White Sox fan by the name of Charles K. Nims, who was named in the criminal prosecution as being defrauded by the players. The players were found not guilty. These very highly skilled attorneys who were connected to organized crime kind of appeared out of nowhere to defend the players. Many people think that team owner Charles Comiskey might have paid for these attorneys with the idea that he wanted his players to sort of get a slap on the wrist or at least humiliated in public. But they were kicked out of baseball right after the trial by Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who had some shady dealings himself, but was the brand new commissioner of Major League Baseball and based in Chicago, which had the commissioner's office for decades.
Fascinating. Was sports gambling illegal at the time? Is another way of asking that question.
Because right.
I'm thinking, was it?
Elliot, maybe you have some insight.
I'm not
there.
Sure, actually. How? Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's local law. And I, even if it was illegal, there's a lot of legal gambling in that era. I'm trying to think. I don't know that it was illegal in Chicago. It certainly. That's a really great question. You know, I just don't know if simply gambling on a sport. I don't believe that's. Oh man, you got me.
Sorry, yeah. So much for asking the experts.
Yeah, eh? Yeah, right. That's right. Edit that out. Get rid of that. Yeah.
I'm not going to get that out.
Oh man.
No, because the question. No, when Peter said that this was an issue of defrauding the public trust, it occurred to me that maybe, you know, if gambling were illegal, you can't sue someone
right.
for defrauding you if you're doing illegal. It's like a drug dealer calling the police and saying another drug dealer stole my drugs.
Right.
And I want you to arrest him
right.
for theft.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I thought.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on. Elliot, would you like to comment on the Black Sox scandal? Did you have anything you wanted to add?
Not a lot, just to say that I think Peter covered that well, but it's hard to also give a sense of just how big an event that is in sport in that era. You know, sort of captured in that romantic, the kid saying to Shoeless Joe Jackson, say it ain't so, Joe, and he hangs his head. He can't tell the kid that they didn't throw the World Series. And Fitzgerald, as Peter says, did use that as a moment in the Great Gatsby that one or a few people could play with the emotions of a whole nation. It sort of encapsulates some of that. It encapsulates some of how we irrationally, maybe for whatever reason, are so attached to our sports. It matters so much to us, and we come to have a relationship almost with the players. If again, I'm a Cubs fan. If I were to suddenly find out that players that I particularly like were throwing the games, were not playing, were not doing their best to play, I would be hurt. I would be just hurt by it. So the Black Sox scandal does have that impact, and certainly Charles Comiskey was trying very much to. There's another way of telling that story about the great lawyers that suddenly appear. Who hired them? And certainly one way of thinking about that is that Comiskey was protecting, to use a contemporary term, protecting his brand. That the White Sox are not at fault, but we're getting rid of these players anyway. We're going to maintain the clean image of the franchise and of baseball, excise the players themselves, and just do it that way. It's back to the story of the power of ownership. Of the owners and before players' unions, the relative powerlessness of players.
So this is also the few bad apples argument from the ownership. Oh, it was just some bad apples.
Yes.
But the institution itself is clean. Is this why the name then changed from the Black Sox to the White Sox?
They were always the White Sox. The name change is really to the Black Sox after they throw the World Series. They had been the Chicago White Sox from the time the American League is formed at the beginning of the century.
So the Black Sox is just a term of
opprobrium.
Yes. Very good.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. Well, they were pissed off.
We do 4-syllable words in this podcast.
All right.
Okay. So maybe one final point about baseball now before we move on to American football. Can we talk a little bit about the divide in Chicago between the White Sox and the Cubs? And I just maybe should note, I've been talking about Zsangpaulí and Hamburg like it's the only show in town. But just like Chicago, Hamburg actually has two teams, and I just won't discuss the other team. So sorry if anyone's listening who supports the other team. We don't care. But Chicago has two important baseball teams, the White Sox and the Cubs. So maybe we can just talk a little bit about their differences and maybe some social points about the divide or perceived divide between the north side of Chicago, where the Cubs reside, and the south side, where the White Sox reside. Elliot?
Yeah, two teams, one National League, the Cubs, the older team, the senior circuit, as the National League is called, the American League on the south side. South side, historically, not so much poorer in parts, but more African-American, a larger African-American population. More just generally more minority. So sometimes in some ways the teams are characterized that way. The Cubs tend to be, they have been historically and especially recently, a whiter audience, a little more prosperous, more popular. There's a real resentment across, or maybe that's too strong a word, a real rivalry of the two teams. North side and south side is some of it. Working class, middle class seems to come into it. But also, it appears also in terms of just the White Sox in recent years and recent decades have been less successful, not on the field, but in terms of attracting a clientele, in terms of being the Chicago team, the popular team. almost two-thirds of Chicagoans consider themselves Cubs fans, not White Sox fans.
Is this a statistic that you are certain of? I'm just curious.
I'm not certain of a third, of one-third to two-thirds. I'm pretty certain of...
Okay.
I'm pretty certain of...
It's a majority.
60-40. Yeah, there's real rivalry between the two. And that rivalry gets, I think, expressed more at White Sox resentment of the Cubs. Why are these guys so popular? They've not been very good. 1907, they win the World Series. The next time they win the championship, it's 2016. Over 100 years. Disappointment after disappointment. Whereas the White Sox, while not a... successful franchise. They do make it to the World Series in 1959. They win the World Series in 2005. So there is this rivalry.
Peter?
Yeah, I mean, as Elliot was laying out the differences, I was reminded of a passage roughly paraphrasing from Bill Veeck's book, Veeck as in Wreck. And Bill, his father was general manager, essentially, for the Cubs, and he worked for the Cubs. And then he owned the White Sox a couple of different times, including the time that they went to the World Series in 1959. And in Veeck as in Wreck, he says, you know, a White Sox fan, this is, of course, mid-20th century, a White Sox fan is a plumber, is a carpenter, is a bricklayer. He wakes up in the morning and it's like, when is the next White Sox game? A Cubs fan is a banker, a lawyer, a judge. He plays a round of golf and then says, you know, when is first pitch? So I think especially in Chicagoans' minds, that's like how things have been cemented over the years. In terms of like working class, South Side, upper class, North Side.
Yeah, okay. I just also might want to respond to what Elliot said about why are the Cubs so popular? And this goes back to, I guess, the media history of sports. But one of the first national networks was WGN, the local Chicago station happened to own the Cubs too. And so they would air baseball games all year round around the whole country when baseball was not on television anywhere else. So people from all over the country, if they wanted to watch baseball on TV, there was only one game to watch on TV, and that was the Cubs games.
Right.
And just having done that gave them this bizarre following around the country. And that's just kind of media history. Peter?
Yeah. And I think even maybe this hemisphere, I mean, there's over the years when the Tribune Media, Tribune, whatever, owned the Cubs, you know, the players would come through from, you know, Venezuela, for example, and say, yes, I grew up watching the Cubs. And the White Sox were only broadcast locally on Channel 44 at WSNS.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah.
I remember.
Yeah.
And it only changed pretty recently. Mm-hmm. Is it a little more than a decade, I think, since WGN, World's Greatest Network, as they styled themselves, broadcast the Cubs, everywhere. Cubs fans everywhere. I mean, there were only two other clubs that broadcast nationally, and they came later to it. Atlanta, the Braves, and the Mets.
And there's also the, like, Wrigleyville and Lakeview, the community area. Of course, the gentrification of that area, sometimes called America's largest outdoor beer garden, you know, around the time of Cubs games, before and after. Just a better effort by sort of capitalist forces to develop the neighborhood. So when you would see it on WGN, I want to go there. I want to go and sit, you know, in the bleachers or the rooftops or behind home plate.
One of the criticisms of FC Tsangpauli is that since so many people buy their merchandise, because they have a really distinctive skull and crossbones logo, that's something if you've seen, you will never forget it. Other soccer fans accuse FC Tsangpauli of being a fashion company with a football team attached to it. And the Cubs brand, it is more like a brand. It's like a lifestyle slash fun weekend with an activity going to the baseball game attached to it. So anyway, yeah.
And that's really part of the business culture of sports and particular teams making decisions, the Cubs prime among them, to develop just the whole neighborhood, not around the stadium, to the extent they can. Certainly, again, the owner of the White Sox, Jerry Reinsdorf, he also owns, as I say, the Chicago Bulls basketball team, made the decision to build that stadium on the south side, kind of on the model of stadia that had been built in the 60s, with a lot of parking around the stadium, nothing else but parking. So you're in this kind of wasteland of, you take the train down or you drive down, and then you're in this, there's the stadium and parking, huge parking lots. The Cubs had the advantage of this old stadium that they sometimes thought about tearing down and moving to the burbs, but they never did. Wrigley Field has been there for over 100 years, and they keep renovating and renovating. It sometimes feels like it's almost unrecognizable, and the neighborhood certainly isn't recognizable. But yeah, it has become very much a kind of, I won't quote Lee Elia, who was the he was the manager of the Cubs back in the early 80s, and he was once very angry at the media, and he went off on the Cubs at that time were, as they used to say, couldn't draw flies. They were drawing very few fans, and they were very, very tough on the Cubs. And Lee Elia, it's a famous, if you go to YouTube and say, I'm not advising anyone to do this, to go to YouTube and type in Lee Elia, E-L-I-A, Lee Elia's rant, you'll hear 2.5 minutes of pure swearing that is just poetry. It is just poetry. It's so good.
I will put a link to it in the show notes.
Absolutely. It's quite amazing.
Okay, well, let's move on now from baseball, where we have a divided city with the White Sox and the Cubs, to something that most, but not all, Chicagoans will agree on, our national American football team, the Chicago Bears. So who wants to start here giving us a little brief introduction to the Chicago Bears?
Since I'll probably have less to say, I'll start. the National Football League is really, really emerges just after World War I, so early in the 20th century. And it's a very small league made up of teams from really heavily Midwestern industrial sites. So the Chicago Bears begin as the, they're called the Staleys. Staley is a corn processing company. They're not in Chicago originally. They're in DeKalb, Illinois. The Green Bay Packers, the only, as you pointed out, Andrew, the only team owned by the public, is a relic of that era, of the beginnings of the National Football League. It's almost as if you're talking about two different sports in the, really beyond the first half of the 20th century. Really, it's only into the 60s that the NFL, the National Football League, really becomes a kind of national institution that people are really interested in. It's a television sport, the same way basketball is a television sport. One thing just to say about sports generally, when I was a kid, and I'm quite old, baseball, boxing, and horse racing were the three great American sports. Baseball, boxing, and horse racing, not football, not basketball. And they really emerge, begin with television, starting in the 50s, but especially in the 60s and going into the 70s. And that's where really American football, as we call it, really becomes the sport we know today.
Peter?
Yeah. These small Midwestern cities, Rock Island, Canton, where the Pro Football Hall of Fame is today, Portsmouth, Ohio, I think it, especially for a franchise like the Chicago Bears, has allowed that mystique to build around it. The monsters of the Midway, whenever Chicago Bears are on a national broadcast, typically the Sandberg, City of broad shoulders, stacker of wheat, packer of meat, etc., is pulled out as like, this is a working class team. This is a team that grew out of the working class communities across the Midwest. So it definitely allows an opportunity to promote that mystique.
Right. And it was important then for immigrant communities too. So working class, but also immigrant communities. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, in some places famous and in many other places infamous, George Halas, the son of, I believe, Czech immigrants, those early 20th century sports like baseball and football were a way to learn what it meant to be a U.S. citizen and to live in a place like Chicago and to learn sort of the rules of being an American, so to speak. And also by being a fan, that could help you find an identity that was rooted here and not rooted in your most likely European homeland.
Especially for the children of immigrants, the immigrants themselves, but even more for their kids, identifying with sports, baseball, especially in that earlier era, but later football really became a part of identifying with America very, very, very powerfully, really.
I'm also kind of interested in this idea that the Staleys being potentially something like a factory team, were they sponsored first by the company?
Yep.
Because you get a lot of this also that in the founding of the European soccer leagues, many of the teams originated as factory teams. So it would be a factory team in Manchester playing a factory team in Liverpool, and eventually they, and the same with the big industrial cities in Italy, like Juventus and Turin. These were teams that were essentially working men's teams, and then they would eventually they became professional leagues. But the origins were always in factories and in industrialization. So I think that's quite interesting, and it also roots these teams in their community in a special way.
There's also always a second layer to football that's going on at the same time that's very different and does speak to class very much. And that is especially beginning in the 1890s. So even before the professional NFL, there's college football. It's hard for people to believe that the University of Chicago down on the South Side was once a football power, an absolute power in football. And it was in an era when also teams like, well, some of the big state universities like Michigan develop a little later, usually Notre Dame. Again, it's heavily Midwestern, not entirely. Rutgers, for example, is an early program. And then certainly by the 20s, it's completely national. Berkeley and Stanford have their rivalry out on the West Coast. But it's almost a separate story. I mean, those colleges are going to college then as now is a fairly elite thing to do. So the game is really going on at two different levels. The professional, often working class factory associated level, and then college, the college game.
And now they've kind of joined. Although now things are so crazy with
one becomes the minor league for the other, yeah. Basically. The unpaid free minor league. Nice deal.
Yep. So we mentioned the Packers are the last remaining major sports team in the United States that has a sort of community ownership model. But all these other teams with the concept of expansion and moving teams, it just shows that even though, like, can we ever really imagine the Chicago Bears leaving Chicago? Actually, in all of the major sports, teams leave all the time. And it would be hard to, for example, for a German to understand St. Pauli leaving Hamburg and saying, we're going to Berlin because we've got a better deal there. Mm-hmm. So I mean, again, I keep focusing on this attachment to the local fan base. But if a franchise can just up and leave, why do we support these clubs?
I mean,
why do we have this undying faith in the Cubs when they can just up and go to Las Vegas tomorrow, or the White Sox?
Right. I mean, Chicago had two NFL franchises, right? The Bears and the Cardinals, and like the Cubs and the Sox, North Side, South Side. Cardinals left for St. Louis, then they left St. Louis for Arizona. And I mean, there are still some people who are Chicago Cardinals fans and didn't transfer their love to the St. Louis Cardinals or the Arizona Cardinals. Yeah.
Funny.
So Jerry Reinsdorf, whom Elliot has mentioned several times, owner of the White Sox, has threatened numerous times to move his team.
Just before this horrible, disastrous season,
yes,
he was making noise about moving to Nashville. In fact, this horrible, disastrous team, if he went to sell the White Sox, they would be worth billions of dollars, literally billions of dollars. It's not a great system. It's very good for the owners. It's become quite good for the players. But as to answer your question one way, Andrew, as the American comedian Jerry Seinfeld said, you know, if players can move around from team to team without loyalty, and also I would add, if teams can move from city to city, we're all just rooting for the laundry, you know, it's just the laundry that we're, you know, whatever these guys are wearing. Now, it doesn't feel that way. At the Cubs game last night, a friend of mine who I was with turns to me and the Cubs finally win it, late innings, 7-6. And this team is lost. This team is not going anywhere in the playoffs, right? We're going to 9 more games or whatever it is. And the season ends. And he looks at me and he just says, hope. Somehow this gives us hope. I don't know what it is. And I would be lying if I didn't admit that sometimes if I'm lying awake in the middle of the night and want to get back to sleep and calm myself down, I will think about great plays or victories or how can we tinker with the lineup to get a better result? It's really sick stuff. I mean, yeah, get help.
Maybe you missed your true calling. Maybe you should have been a baseball manager.
I think I should get help. I should seek professional counseling.
I mean, the 7 million or so people who turned out for the Cubs victory parade, you know, just under 8 years ago, like, that was something like the 10th largest gathering of humans ever in the history of the recorded audiences. You know,
wow.
Like, it says something about those, you know, the blue pinstripe laundry that Jerry Seinfeld is talking about, I guess. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't begin to explain it, why. And again, I didn't grow up a Cubs fan. I grew up a Dodger fan, a successful team, no less. I can't begin to explain it. I happened to have the TV on the other day, and they were replaying the playoff before the World Series and of the National League Championship Series in 2016, when the Cubs beat the LA Dodgers. And I am just grinning from ear to ear watching this. It made me feel so happy. It's stupid, but there I am. It probably bespeaks an empty life, you know?
Leave that in. That's classic Elliot.
I'm gonna leave that in.
All right.
I'm going to make a semi-serious point about capitalism now, if I may.
Please.
Extremely intelligent capitalists have realized that fans' loyalty to this thing, irrational though it is, they will keep paying for tickets, they will keep watching, they will keep buying gear, and there's practically nothing you can do to turn them off that loyalty. And so what it is a license to print money. And it's almost like an abusive relationship. You try to see, if you're Jerry Reinsdorf, how much can I abuse my fans? And yet they keep coming to the games. And he's clearly said, I can abuse them quite a bit.
That is exactly the way another friend of mine puts it, that it is an abusive relationship, and especially that if you bring your kids to the Cubs, for example, you should be forced to go to protective services, you know, to have these children taken away from their parents or something.
Right. To the Cubs or the White Sox?
The Cubs. Because don't forget, the Cubs are successful economically. But it's not as if they've been a successful ball club.
Yeah, in fact, wasn't their nickname the Lovable Losers?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Right.
And what their first baseman, Mark Grace, used to say, what do you call a lovable loser? Loser.
All right. Moving on to the next team, very famous worldwide to this day. Just walking around Hamburg, I will see every day a White Sox hat, a Cubs hat. I will see a Bears sweater or a Bears winter hat, but I will also see every type of Bulls gear, including kids wearing Michael Jordan shoes, Michael Jordan shorts, Michael Jordan everything. And obviously, I think in the last 40 years, has anyone been more influential in putting Chicago on the global map than Michael Jordan of the Chicago Bulls?
Yeah, I was in 1988, I was a guest student at the University of Zagreb in Croatia, which was then Yugoslavia. And we had a welcome meal, and they, in the apartment next to us, there was graffiti, and it was Vlade Divac, of course, from Yugoslavia, but then Michael Jordan, and much more Michael Jordan graffiti than Vlade Divac. And that was before the double, three-peats. Yeah. I mean, it's often said that it's trying to help erase, like, Chicago as the shoot 'em up Al Capone town, right? The 90s Bulls, especially.
Yeah, those are the two rivalries for fame in Chicago, Al Capone and Michael Jordan. You know, if you mention Chicago to someone, everyone says overseas, and they'll either say a cabbie or whomever, Michael Jordan or Al Capone. It is quite amazing. I mean, I think one of the things that causes that is the fact that the NBA, certainly much more than Major League Baseball or the NFL, has spread the word and made itself into the basketball into an international game. So many players recruited from Europe, from Asia, from Africa. Now you see much less of that. Like, that's just so widespread worldwide in the other sports. Baseball has, you know, some attraction in Latin America, some in Asia. It's growing, certainly, but not like football. I mean, like basketball, I'm sorry. And also, yeah, it's Michael Jordan. That was just such an amazing moment. You know, six championships. Peter will remember that. Peter and I worked on years ago an exhibit at the Chicago History Museum called Chicago Sports. You should have been there. And we had a lot of wonderful artifacts, including the NBA was willing to loan us all three trophies from the Chicago Bulls victories. And on the first day, on the opening day, there's a kid in his teens. He comes in, he's looking at the various stuff. He sees the six trophies, and he literally drops to his knees and crosses himself. I mean, that's how deep the stuff can run.
Yeah, so why is it that basketball is so important to the city of Chicago besides the Bulls? I think it also has something to do with, let's face it, racial, economic, and social issues. Unlike baseball, which takes many hours to play and you need a big field and specialized gear, American football is, of course, hugely infrastructure intensive to play properly. And yet we note that a basketball hoop can be created basically with anything. You can put just a bin in the air and play basketball. And so maybe we can focus a little bit on some of those racial, social, and urban issues that go to the importance of basketball in Chicago.
Well, basketball certainly is the city game in that sense. And its association with African Americans goes back a ways. Now, maybe not as far as many people think, but certainly by the 1960s and even a little before that, the game is being played very widely in playgrounds. It's also exactly what you said, Andrew. You don't need as much space. You don't need as much equipment. Jerry West famously begins his memoir, his autobiography, the great Jerry West, who just passed away. Basketball is a game that a boy can play alone, literally just laying up the ball, taking shots. And that's part of it. It does become very much in New York and Chicago. Chicago, by the 1960s, is about a third African American, and that's a big piece of it too. So in inner cities, as people used to call them, or the ghetto, as people used to call it, it's a popular game, very popular.
I think, you know, Derrick Rose, who for a while seemed like he might bring the Bulls back to prominence earlier in the 2000s, famously from Chicago, famously played on an outdoor playground that if you Google, you can find, you know, where it was. And you know, I think that that adds to the mystique. And yeah, Illinois, the state of Illinois, especially Chicago and some of the other smaller urban areas, produces lots of great college players. And like pro football, college basketball is sort of the minor leagues to the National Basketball Association, aside from all the recruiting from Europe and Asia and Africa.
And there really, it was and probably still is basketball, even though it's become a mega sport and a mega business and so on. You know, you think back, there was a player in New York, Connie Hawkins, who played in the NBA. But Hawkins remained, this is going back to the 60s, but this is still true. Exactly what Peter was getting at with Rose. The city game, the street game is still, people are legendary. And remembered, and stories told, and Hawkins was that way. It was as much his efforts in Harlem as later in the NBA that got all the attention.
Yeah, and maybe I might just close by going to this concept of it's a sport that a kid can play by himself, because the other sport that a kid can play by himself, of course, is soccer. And it's interesting to see why in the U.S. soccer didn't develop the same way it did in Europe. But certainly what we often see in Europe is kids who grew up playing street ball just on their corner with the soccer ball with kids, then becoming pros. But they'll always go back every year to the neighborhood they come from and play soccer with the kids on the street or in the local park because you just need a ball. And I do hear lots of stories about basketball players going back. In fact, pros sometimes just show up at places and play street games with pretty good players because there's pretty high quality basketball going on at the right places at the right times, if you know about it in Chicago. So just taking then this back from Chicago to Hamburg, we'll just say I'm hoping very much so that FC St. Pauli will somehow get a player like Michael Jordan to give us 6 championships sometime. And I'm not sure that'll happen, but that's what I'm hoping for. Okay. I don't know who I have to get down on my knees and pray to for that to happen.
Good luck.
Yeah. Okay. Hope, as they say, hope. Peter Alter, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Elliot Gorn, thank you as well.
Andrew, thanks to you. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
And everyone, thanks for listening to the Chicago Hamburg 30 podcast and support your local team. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan, not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.